นะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะพุทธังธัมมังสังฆังนะโมสามิSo today is the full moon of August, one of our observance days. And the bhikkhus and arhats will enter the second vasa tomorrow, which means they'll begin the time of the traditional rains retreat, traditional in India and Thailand, where it's the monsoon.And that's a time where, which is kind of more replicated in our winter retreat, I think, really, because summers are rather busy. But the spirit of Vasa is one of spending a lot of time reflecting on training. So in our monasteries in Thailand, there'd be a reading on the training, maybe every day or...some gathering every week, so a lot of emphasis on the ways of a samana, the ways of a monastic, the etiquette, the deportment, the deference to the relationship between senior and junior, the moral rules, the style of a monastery. There's so many things that we try to train in and have common agreements around. That's called Vinaya. And those kind of common principles that we use help us to define our life in a way which isn't just personal. So it's not simply my idea that, say, monks don't use money.The way it was set up in the time of the Buddha, so it's not my particular idea or Ajahn Khuslo's, it's just the way that monastery functions. And then there are kind of subtleties around that or different ways that the Vinaya can be interpreted. So we also have the Thai forest tradition that we're a part of.And in England, they call it the English countryside tradition. So there's kind of changes and ways of doing it, which are more from our monasteries in England. And then there's Perth, the kind of way you do it, the way we do it. And then there's each individual monk's perception of that also. So it's interesting trying to find...a common ground, a common agreement on these rules that we live by, and yet seeing that if one were to, there's no, one can't pin it down exactly, otherwise one would become obsessed with rule keeping. So there's a famous story of a monastery in Thailand where two monks have a vicious argument about pickled garlics.And you know, where they get so obsessed with an interpretation of a particular rule, and both are, you know, kind of have their way of interpreting it, and what they forget is, of course, the essence of life, which is friendship. So we have, in our training as monastics, we have these principles that we live by, but also we have this reminder from the texts.The reminder to Ananda that the spiritual life, the holy life, is Ananda. You know the line where the Buddha asks Ananda, and he says, "It's 50% friendship." And he says, "No, it's 100% friendship." And you can see if there isn't a sense of friendship and amity in any kind of a structure, and the lay people live by the structure too, it's not just us. If there isn't that heartfelt friendship, then one can get quite insensitive with rules. And yet, if there's no structure, if there's no agreed way of doing it, there can be a lot of friction because we just, each of us does it according to our moods, our preferences, our views and opinions. So this combination of structures and boundaries and disciplines and rules and precepts and etiquettes and all of that, and then friendship, is, I think, the spirit, the way we try to develop our lives here and develop the monastery. So the friendship, whatever way we might define it personally, one of the ways we can define it from the text is the Brahmaviharas. When we are connected with each other in a sense of, I really wish you well in this life. I don't wish you ill. I wish you well. May you be well and happy. Compassion, appreciation for the good things in your own life, the things that you do well, as opposed to competition and jealousy, and a certain sense of peacefulness in the heart, equanimity. And an equanimity which is connected, rather than equanimity which is cold and dismissive or aloof or whatever. And then within that, if one makes that one of the foundations of our spiritual life, then the ways we do it, the practical ways we live and the etiquettes that we use, one can use that as a kind of mirror to how one's interpreting this life. And it's a very good mirror. Friendship is a great mirror. If I really reflect on friendship and I'm feeling annoyed at someone in the community, and then I want to criticize that person because they're doing something I perceive to be wrong, or even I know, say, in the rules, but it's not from friendship, then I can reflect, well, maybe just the only reason I really want to criticize them because I don't like them, or I don't like what they're doing, or I don't like how they behave. And that's important, because then I awaken in my own heart to aversion, and I don't just use rule keeping as a way of oppressing people or intimidating them or doing whatever. On the other hand, I have a responsibility to the structures and rules that I live by, and that personal responsibility is a way of also being friends with others. Because if I just did this life the way I want to do it, the way I interpret it, but there is a common agreement that we've agreed upon, and I think, well, you know, that's not important. This way is important. That's selfish. So I impact others by just reinterpreting it according to my own desires and greed or aversion, and that's not friendly either. Right? So, well, if you've ever... I've not lived in relation. I guess I have lived in a relationship with my mother now for 6 years. You know, actually, I've got a lot of insight about marriage. Oddly enough, really, you know, because my own socializing, I suppose, has come through community. Most of my adult life has been in community, so I've learned my sort of social skills with groups of people. So now with Mum, getting a lot of insight about what relationship might be. It's not quite that, but but friendship, like the mirror of friendship, just a very simple mirror like that, if I take it on board, not as a not just as like I shouldn't hate anyone, or I shouldn't be bad, or, you know, that kind of silliness. But really, you know, what is friendship like? What is connection like? And then seeing the people that I live with, can I cultivate friendship with them as well as living by a set of rules? Now, living in a monastery for whatever period of time, whether it's a day or 34 years or whatever, we don't come together because we are intimate friends. We come together because we are interested in Dhamma. You know, we want to understand this teaching. We want to understand ourselves. So we come together with people who are strong-minded or have different ways of interpreting life and so on. So we come up to friction. We feel intimidated by someone or feel angry at someone. Maybe this is, of course, more true when you live in a place, obviously, because it becomes more intense than if you are a visitor. But the mirror of friendship then is a very kind of sobering and honest consideration, isn't it? And that really puts into perspective my critical mind, the mind which might be very judgmental or critical. And the other, surrendering to the rules, surrendering to a form, surrendering to a discipline, is a kind of giving up the way I'd like to do something for the sake of a larger group. So it's kind of compassionate and friendly. So it's quite, if it's done well, it's quite beautiful. But it's not easy, you know, because of what? Because of desire, because of the habits of aversion, because of the habits of fear, because of the projections I have from when I was a kid and that I project onto the leaders or, you know, whatever it is. So although the ideal is very beautiful of friendship, what arises in community is also defilement. All of us we witness certain kinds of defilements, and I'm sure that's true in marriage and work and so on. It's just natural. So then in a world where there is no reflection or no taking of inner responsibility, where there's no real consideration, then the inner conflict that one has, there tends to be just a tendency just to blame or to distract. You know, the problem is you. If you leave, I'll be happy. Or the problem is I need more of these because I don't have enough of it. So there's greed and fear and anger functioning. And so the non-reflective person is seeking happiness through the pursuit of pleasure and the avoidance of pain. Right? And we all do that. Like if you're thirsty, I drink water. You're uncomfortable, you move your knee, and you're a bit bored, you watch a Batman movie. Whatever people do. So that's just in the nature of things, and we need that. But if our inner world, if we think that the cure for our inner suffering and the conflicts we have is the pursuit of external pleasures and the avoidance of external pain, then of course we are always victim to these external changes. So in the cultivation of inner peace and inner joy and inner happiness, we still are pursuing pleasure. We're still using the same way that the mind functions, but now we're doing it inside. So if I'm living in community and I find someone is irritating me, then that very contraction or that irritation is not happy. I'm not happy. I'm not relaxed. And my task is, how can I live with this person in this form, in this structure, and relax the heart? So I'm still moving towards happiness, obviously. I'm still using that principle that we have as humans, the pursuit of pleasure and the avoidance of pain, but I'm no longer simply dependent and blaming on externals, right? So something presses my button, and if my aversion button, and if I'm on the game, I can see my mind wanting to blame that person, or project onto that person, or even blame myself. But if I'm on the game, I just say, ah, this is aversion. Like I was saying last week, bird watching, this is a heron, this is a crow, huh? This is aversion. Aversion feels this way. Now when I do that, then I have aversion, I've got it in the binoculars now, right? I can see it. I'm no longer stuck with it. I'm no longer attached. So objectivity. And in that objectivity, I can say, that's tension. That the heart's closed, the stomach's tight, or whatever. And then my task is to learn that this aversion, how can I relax away from it? How can I let go? So it's still the happiness is still a goal. It's just done from the inside, without dismissing the very natural function of seeking comfort and eating food and going for nice walks in the woods. There's still that kind of external happiness and pleasure, but that is limited. So when what we try to do in our monastic life is set up a very good set of mirrors and boundaries within which there's a certain amount of harmony, you know, like we come together and we're able to sit together. So we have a 2 o'clock sitting, and this evening we have a 7 o'clock sitting. So that gives us some sense of it's a very positive thing, isn't it? You know, we come together and we sit. But within the boundaries of the meditation hall, we also face a conflict, like wanting to leave, or it's too hot, or the person beside me is shuffling too much, or like last week, my alarm clock didn't work. So it was longer than 45 minutes or whatever. So within a form which is helpful, we have conflict, which is suffering. But we keep to the form rather than just switch the form around every time we feel uncomfortable, because that would be endless. So rather than each of us deciding how long we're going to sit, so then, you know, someone decides to leave after 15 minutes and someone decides to leave after 10 minutes. That would just be this kind of hopeless individuality, right? So we have community, we have communal agreements, and then we have individuality. We have the happiness and unhappiness that we experience as individuals. And surrendering to the form is like you give up this tendency to always just recreate the form to some ideal of perfection or whatever you think it should be. If you can give up to that and then watch the conflict, then there's a kind of freedom there, isn't there? There's a freedom to watch rather than to change. And this is the sort of the design principle of monastic training, one of the principles of monastic training, that by agreeing to a form, agreeing to a structure, it really helps. It's really lovely. It really carries you. But within that carrying, there's also the desire mind and the greed mind and the anger mind keep hitting things. People, one doesn't like the way they function, or fearfulness of someone, or boredom, or whatever it is. And because if the form and structure is very, very clear, then as these frustrations come into consciousness, you say, oh, that's tension. That's tensing up. So how can I relax with this one? And then you see then the form liberates. Why? Because one is using the form to understand oneself, and in understanding one becomes able to be in a situation inwardly very, very free. And then if one leaves the form, you leave the monastery and you have to... I remember when I had to go to Bangkok, my first year in Thailand, I had to go down to Bangkok for a visa or something. And Ajahn Chah's monastery, very, very tranquil, no distractions, Bangkok, absolute zoo, right? I think it took me about 3 months to recover, because my senses were just totally bombarded. Right? So it's a very, very protective kind of space, but in itself it can be an attachment. So there are situations where you know, we're faced with things where we're not protected by form, and then we see how we react to that. But the inner reactions that we have, we're always moving towards peace, aren't we? We're moving towards... we are moving towards happiness, but it's a happiness which is more profound than just getting what you want. So the wanting is frustrated. What I want, or what I expect, or what I project, that's frustrated, and that frustration and disappointment is the real... It's the grit of the... It's the friction of the practice. It's what gives you traction. Rule keeping, or all like the way one interprets the how to keep these rules or how to live the life. I mean, I've seen so many monasteries, there's so many styles of doing it, and some monasteries become very, very fearful of rules. So what I've noticed, say, sometimes is like, I'm trying to think of an example, like with lay people sometimes, you won't know quite what the rules are, and no one will be quite sure, and everyone will be watching everyone else. So then one person will go in Anjali, right? And everyone else will be doing Anjali. And maybe the monks don't even say you have to do that. or what have I noticed? Like I'll come into a... Our tradition is that whenever you come into the shrine room, you bow to the shrine, right? Mm-hmm. So you come to the shrine, you bow to the shrine. And I've noticed in the days of mindfulness, whenever I come into the shrine room, even if the sittings have been running and we've done the opening, if I bow, then Nisanka starts to bow, Hemanta, then everyone starts to bow. They don't know if we're supposed to bow or not. So like the whole group takes on this kind of, should we do this or should we not do this? Right? Which is fine. It's just the way groups function. But so what we're trying to do as a monastery is we're trying to educate ourselves and educate the laity to a certain form and a certain structure, but it's not absolute. So if another monastery does it a bit different, or what is absolute is like moral precepts. Right? This is just a particular style of doing things, just a particular way to do it. But people get very attached to that. You know, well, our monastery doesn't do it that way. So even within that, they bow more quickly than us, or I'm more holy because I put my hands out this way rather than that way, and it can get quite silly that way. But if we always stick to friendliness, if we make that the kind of the trump card, right? Then if we go to another place or another monk comes, or that isn't part of our training, if it's friendliness, you can't delude yourself into self-righteousness, because that's the danger of rule-keeping. One of them is self-righteousness. You know, I'm more pure than you. I remember going to a very senior monk who wasn't part of our tradition. He was a very well-loved monk in Bangkok. And he was allowing his name to be used for the collecting of money for a hospital. Very generous thing to do. And he had on his table, a lot of lay people just coming, he had a whole wad of notes. He saw me coming, he was just going to pile them into his desk, close the desk, and talk with me. Right? Now, I could have just looked at him, oh, disgusting, using money, filthy lucre. But if you're practicing friendliness, then I noticed, well, that, wait a minute, where are you coming from? That's self-righteous. You're just full of your own conceit about what the rules are. You're not really aware. So friendliness is this lovely kind of mirror. Now, if there is someone who is like really morally misbehaving, right, I can certainly call them on it and say, well, that's inappropriate. That's not how we live or whatever. But friendliness will show me where I'm coming from. Am I coming from a sense of what is appropriate, or am I just coming from my own fears, my own projections, my own self-righteousness? And that's very important, because certainly that's been the bane of traditional religion, is this kind of conceit and fear and self-righteousness. So if we don't really know the rules and so on, then we can have a lot of fear or nervousness. And the thing about, I think for the laity to remember, is you can't break my rules. Only I can do that. So if you think you've made a faux pas, if you have no intention, it's not really a faux pas. Right? So if you give me a glass of whiskey and I drink it, that's my broken the precepts, not you. Don't do it. Right? So what we're trying to do in a monastery is get everyone to try to figure out how to do, and that takes a while, so everyone's a bit nervous, right? But once you get the sense of it, then it's like more like just a beautiful dance. You know, when to bow, you know what the chanting's about, you know the relationship of monastic to lay person, and hopefully we don't inject fear into it. You know, there's the authority figure, behave now, right? That we do this because it's beautiful to do, it's appropriate to do, it's correct to do. So any amount of fear that arises, like in a relationship between junior and senior, or monastic or laity, quite often there can be a lot of fear with authority figures and people who have power and so on. And then if you're using the mirror of friendliness, you watch, well, am I now behaving out of fear? Or can I watch that fearfulness and not just behave from that space and go back to the space of friendliness? Because friendliness is very relaxed. They're very connected. Brahmiharas are very relaxed, aren't they? They're very connected. And so we learn, you know, we learn. Or if a monk, you know, Bill Gates comes in the gate and I become very obsequious and say, sorry guys, you know, I'm going to see Bill Gates, I need to pay the mortgage. That's not friendliness. That's manipulativeness or whatever it might be. So a simple thing like that, like the sense of what are the Brahmaviharas? What are they not as a theory, but what, you know, when I'm connected to other people and to nature, that what is that, to get really familiar with that, and then when that's not there, to look at that tension and learn how can I relax back into the Brahmaviharas, how can I relax back into connection, and then the aversions that arise and the fearfulnesses that arise and the self-disparagement that arise become the real focuses of liberation. I can see, say, with my mother, just sometimes, lots of times, really, I mean, the classic for me is maybe I will have, you know, been kind of busy for 3 hours or whatever, doing this and that, and then just when I'm about to do what I want to do, right, for a walk or whatever, Mom has an idea. And I can just feel the aversion arising. And then I say, this is the practice. This is why you're here. Right? And then I'd be very careful, try to do what she wants me to do. Not, I mean, if I told her I don't want to do that, she'd be fine. She's not a demanding person. But a very good practice. And what am I doing? I'm just letting go of craving. Right? Now, my rational mind can say, well, it's been 3 hours. Can get the violins out. But it's still craving, and it's the frustration of craving, and there's the aversion, and what are you going to do about it? And if I'm really honest, this isn't friendliness, this is defilement, and if I'm just on the game, I say, yeah, but it's a chance. It's a chance to liberate your heart. It's not a chance to get walking, but it is a chance to liberate the heart from aversion. And the more one picks it up that way, just relax the tension, so I'm making the tea or whatever I'm doing, and relax. You'll get for a walk. Don't worry. and that kind of just nitty gritty stuff is what our life is about. It's just little things, constantly applying this kind of gentle attention and knowing yourself better and better. And you don't have to think about it that much. And I think after a while, you know, this is just aversion. This is just greed. Just call it what it is. But not in a self-disparaging way. Just greed, just aversion, just paranoia. And then more and more, that's a tension. Well, can I relax it in the body? That's a tension. How can I relax it in the body? And then we're touching the very, very real things of our heart. And that kind of liberation is not dependent on any external condition. And it's not dependent whether I can go for a walk or not. It's independent. It's freedom. So the boundaries and responsibilities that we live by are helpful containers. They're not absolutes. The friendship gives us the kind of the the Brahma Viharas gives us a general clue or a reminder of what our attitude could be, not should be. So anytime you feel really connected, when you, like, let's say if you're talking to a child, right, and the child is talking about something which is you're not really interested in, right? But you're interested in the child, you don't just dismiss it. Oh, I'm not interested in that. You'll connect with a child, no matter what the child isn't interested in. But then as adults, quite often we only connect with things that we like. So if I'm not interested in baseball and someone talks about sport, I'm not interested in sport, or politics, or gadgets, and so we dismiss people because it doesn't suit our own self-interest. But then there's someone who is interested in what we're interested in, then I'll have some connection with you. It's limited. It's normal. But to actually, like, come across someone who's interested in baseball, and rather than dismiss them, just plug into their interest. Maybe only for 10 minutes. I'm not saying that, you know, all the time, but just to make that exercise of connection, and that's empathy. You know, I connect with someone not because they're just talking about things that I'm interested in. No, I'm just connecting them because they're a human being. That's a grandeur kind of thing. You know, it's not absolute. You can't do it all the time, maybe. But you can see how that comes from not just personal preference and desire and so on. It comes from the Brahma Viharas. Connecting. And you see that with children. And as adults, we just kind of, I'm doing my thing, whatever. So that the times of connection are important to reflect upon, whether, you know, when we're really connected to life with people or nature, whatever, what is the sense of ease? And do I just need to replicate the environment to get that sense of ease? Or is that sense of ease a potential that I can cultivate at times when the externals aren't feeding it? Right? That's the challenge. You know, when the externals and the people aren't feeding that naturally, can I move towards that through practice? And that's a neat challenge, isn't it? That's a really neat challenge. It doesn't happen overnight, but you keep applying that kind of sensitivity and insight and inner vigilance, then more and more the heart knows how to abide in ease, return to ease. Let go of tension. You just get more adept at it. You become the Olympian of ease. You become just very, very good at it. And what could be more important as a human being, but to develop that kind of a skill. All right, so I'll leave that to reflect upon.
Hanmayang Varagata Sadhu Karandamasaya.